In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
Hey, this is the Mighty Manfred, with you again for another Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today I'm joined by musician, songwriter, and producer Kenny Laguna, best known for being Joan Jett's longtime producer and collaborator. But Kenny's career in the music business dates all the way back to his teens, and we'll discuss that career and its accomplishments over the course of two parts. Here in part one, we'll talk about his family and introduction to music, his first paying gig as a 12-year-old performing around New York City and backing artists like the Shangri-Las. We'll also speak of his early days working and writing on bubblegum songs alongside producers Jerry Kazanets and Jeffrey Katz. We'll also talk about his first production gigs, producing the likes of Darlene Love, amongst others. We hear Kenny tell us about a host of hit records he performed on, and one of the first and biggest is Yummy Yummy Yummy. Now, the record label might read Ohio Express on that, but in reality, it was Kenny and his fellow studio musicians performing on the recording. Let's hear some of that now, followed by part one of our Kenny Laguna Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Yummy, 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 I got love in my tummy, and I feel like I'm loving you. Love you, such a sweet thing, good enough to eat thing, and it's just what I'm gonna do. Ooh, love to hold ya, ooh, love to kiss ya, ooh, love, I love it so.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and joining me for today's Coolest Conversations is Kenny Laguna, musician, singer, songwriter, and producer of note. In fact, he's been Joan Jett's longtime producer and collaborator, helping her get her solo career off the ground, and has worked with her since. But we're going to also speak about a lot of the early stuff he did in his career. Got Kenny on the line. How are you, Kenny?
I'm rocking along. How are you?
Oh, man, I'm hanging in there in these COVID times. Have you and your family managed to stay healthy?
So far, so good. I mean, unfortunately, we've lost a few friends of note. A lot of the New York club scene stayed out in the streets a little too long. The clubs stayed open, and unfortunately, a lot of people got sick. So it's been hard that way, but my immediate and extended family so far been lucky. I've been locked down since March 12th.
Where are you, Kenny?
I'm in Long Island.
Okay.
We had a city apartment that we got rid of. John and I shared it. It's in the West Village. We loved it, but due to the encumberment of this plague, we've given it up after many decades, and we're downsizing in every which way.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that both you and Joan and your respective families are staying safe and healthy. You know, I got a chance to speak with Richard Goddard recently, and he had a story about being really young. He was playing piano like around maybe as young as 11 in his parents' brownstone downstairs. The window's open, and a guy walks by and says, "Hey, kid, you're pretty good." And okays it with his parents to take him down to the Brill Building and shows them around. And that's kind of Richard Goddard's introduction to the music business. From what I understand, you have kind of a similar story that you were 12 and playing piano in like high school hops around New York. Or what exactly is that story?
Well, that's a true story. My parents were Greenwich Village. If I called them progressive, that would be underestimating the leftist in them. They were communist and atheist and extreme intellectual egghead people, and music to them was classical or jazz. Mm-hmm. So when I was a little kid, you know, being in the arts, my mother was a painter of some note. My grandfather and my father were both architects. My great-grandfather started out Actors Equity with Lionel Barrymore. So that's where I come from. And wow. Being in the arts was like required mm-hmm. to be respected by family. So I started out learning classical music. And around second grade, I saw Jailhouse Rock. I had to sneak out to see that. And it blew my mind, so I saw that. I also had an aunt who was a beauty queen, and she married a rich guy, and they had all kinds of material things, which my parents kind of looked down on. Mm-hmm. But they had money. I saw Elvis. Elvis, he made art, thought of it that way, and he had money. That was a good combo from my point of view, so... I started learning rock and roll on the piano, and it really upset my mom. And she was like, what do you think this is, a drum? You want a drum? We'll get you a drum. Don't do that to my piano. But I had an aunt. Her name was Lucy Brown, and she was a famous concert pianist. And as a matter of fact, her name is in the song Mack the Knife, because she was friends with Kirk Weill, who wrote Three Penny Opera. Aunt Lucy eventually convinced my parents that pop music was what Mozart was doing in his day. And eventually they softened up. They still wouldn't let me have rock and roll in my life, but they let me have jazz. And jazz had boogie woogie. Mm-hmm. Boogie woogie translated into... There was a lot of boogie woogie in some of Elvis's material. Right. Like guys like Jerry Lee Lewis, Little Richard... That was boogie woogie, and it was completely transferable. And so there was I with a well-known jazz guy, became my teacher. You know, onward from there, I knew every song on the radio. Somehow, I got hooked up with Jack Spector of the WMCA Good Guys, and I'd work for $20, and we'd go from school to school. I guess it was Friday nights, so I don't remember exactly. But there is a photo, and it's online, of me with the Shangri-Las when I was a little kid. And, you know, that's what we would do. And because I knew every song, I was a perfect fit. So that was a perfect fit, $20 a day.
Yeah. Well, let me ask, what year is this, roughly? You said with the Shangri-Las, so is that like about 1964 or 65?
Yeah, probably around there, yeah. Exactly. And you can figure it out, because I remember when I was with the Shangri-Las, their hit of the moment was Give Them a Great Big Kiss.
Okay.
I mean, that's not their most famous hit, but, you know, it's famous to me because that was their current hit. You know?
Right.
You know, they had Leader of the Pack and Remember Walking in the Sand. And I remember that night the Regents were there. They brought their own band. We didn't play with them. I've since learned a lot. The Regents, for those of you who don't know, their big hit was Barbara Ran, only they weren't on the record.
But they sang on the record.
No, they did not.
They did not?
It turns out that record sitting in the can and the label. I believe they sang on their other hit, which was my favorite, called Runaround. It was written by Ernie Maresca. And the Underground Garage is like the only place you'll hear Ernie Maresca's stuff. Right. He wrote Runaround too with Dion
right.
and The Wanderer.
So you were playing piano, backing these people and doing these high school hops. Were you convinced at that point, this is so great, this is what I'm going to do with my life?
Yeah, I was pretty dedicated to that. And yeah, that was my dream. It was like Dion, Elvis, and then when the Beach Boys happened, and then the Beatles and Rolling Stones, probably... It stopped around there. And, you know, like the old rock and roll still does something for me that is, I mean, nothing was ever better than that. The simplicity of it, the, you know, the truth, three chords and the truth. Yeah, that's what I've dedicated my life to, and a certain ethic that I believed in and my partner Joan Jett believes in. And, you know, when you dig down to some of these greats like Chuck Berry, who I had the great fortune to become a little friendly with, you know, you got to dig it out because a lot of these folks are very cynical.
Yeah.
Pete Townsend, you know, because a lot of that's left us as rock and roll became more mainstream. And, you know, I'll never forget, you know, I did have the fortune of managing the Kinks for a while. And I remember when Ray Davis got into the Hall of Fame, he said, I look around, I see everybody all tarted up in their tuxedos, and I realize rock and roll has become respectable. And everybody started cheering. And then he said, what a drag. And there's something to that, too.
Well, let me ask you, you're backing like the likes of the Shangri-Las. How did you wind up playing with like Tommy James and the Shondells? I mean, what led up to that?
Well, I can tell you, so I was, you know, just a guy in a little rock band. And remember, back in those days, you kind of were either a guy who sang and did those cool doo-wop dances, which meant that, you know, you didn't have to be a great dancer. So I was the guy who played.
Right.
And I started writing songs and whatever. And actually, one of my great moments was I played up in the Catskills and Tony Orlando came. Now, he had had two hits that weren't that big, but I didn't know that because I listened to Murray the K on 1010 Winds or 77 ABC, and you heard hits in New York. I didn't know about regional hits. And Tony had Bless You and Halfway to Paradise, and then his career ended for a while. He came up, and I backed him on those things. I met Tony Orlando. I couldn't believe it. I thought I was like, I made it. I met Tony Orlando.
Yeah.
And then I didn't see him for many years. You know, so I was having that kind of career, and I'd run in. I met Screamin' Jay Hawkins. I didn't know who he was until he came up there and did his legendary hit. And so then I got to be about 15, something like that, and one of my high school buddies, not a musician, an athletic guy, went around with me in the city. Oh, somehow out of high school, I got a record deal with United Artists.
Okay.
And so United Artists, the guy who ran the company, his son brought me into his dad, got the record deal. And one day I'm up in the building and they said, we just bought the publishing of Kama Sutra. Now, I thought Kama Sutra was the best place on earth because they had the Love and Spoonful. In my opinion, one of the most underrated bands of all time. So I had the wherewithal at 15 to walk over to Kama Sutra. I met this guy, Howie Kane, really Harry Kirschenbaum, who had just got thrown out of Janie American for attacking Jay on stage in the middle of Karamea during that high note, which we all found a little bit hard to take. But there was Howie, and he listened to my song, Do You Want to Know What I Think? He kept me waiting for like 2 hours, and he came out and he goes, would you like to be a writer for Kama Sutra? Of course I did. I'm still a junior in high school. So I joined Kama Sutra, and I started making demos, which is what we did, and I would play the piano and the guitar, and was making the demos with a band that was called the Tradewinds. It had a song called Mind Excursion and New York's a Lonely Town. Only the band I was playing with, I didn't actually play that first hit, New York's a Lonely Town. That was Anderson Poncia, another whole story.
Okay. But,
so we started making my demos. They asked me to join their band. And in the meantime, the Love and Spoonful got busted in California.
Mm-hmm.
So Zally got taken into jail. And during that night, instead of waiting for, you know, the guys who ran the label, we used to see them on the congressional racketeering, you know, inquiries and stuff. These guys were connected. All Zally had to do was keep his mouth shut. Everything would have been taken care of. But he panicked, and he ratted out the guys. It was only pot. But in those days, things were very illegal. Yeah. So he ratted out the wrong guys. Those guys were connected to this upcoming new thing called FM radio that was fueling the rock revolution. So the Love and Spoonful became the pariahs, and rock radio was doing things like playing one half of the stereo, and the Love and Spoonful became pariahs, and they couldn't, that ruined everything for Kama Sutra. So what did they do? They started a new label, Buddha Records. So instead of doing like the White Motown, all of a sudden, they're doing this new thing called Bubblegum. Right. And guess who was playing all the records? Our little band. Now, we didn't want to be doing nursery rhymes. We wanted to be doing cool music like the Love and Spoonful and the Critters. But, you know, anything to get on the radio. So I remember early on, we made Yummy Yummy. I didn't know that was such a hit, you know. And I remember Bo Gentry, the great writer who wrote, I Think We're Alone Now, he says, this is a smash, and I'm on the record. I go, it's really kind of awful and flat and whatever, you know. But we made that record on a Monday, and by Friday we were hearing it on the radio. That's how fast things worked in those days.
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing led to another. Then there was Green Tambourine. I played harpsichord on that. And I wrote one of the songs in the album called Rainbow Tree. Before we knew it, we had five things on the charts. In a 3.5-year period, we had like 35, 40 hits. I mean, really, we want to figure out we're having as many hits as the Beatles. I mean, but nobody knew who we were.
Right.
Shadows of Night. We didn't do Gloria, but we did Shake. And I've heard Shake on the Underground Garage.
Oh, yes. That's a killer track. Are you playing the organ on Shake? Because that's that little riff there makes the whole song.
Yeah, I'd be playing the organ. And I did a lot of percussion in those days. And they had really good guitar players. So I didn't play a lot of guitar, but I did play the acoustic guitar on a lot of those records. Yeah. And also Gimme Gimme Good Lovin' we did, and 1, 2, 3 Red Light, and Goody Goody Gumdrops.
Well, let me ask you about this, because the Crazy Elephant and a lot of these bubblegum things, they're tacked back to Katz and Kazanets, the production team. Were you working with those guys?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, like the Yummy Yummy album,
yeah.
I played all the instruments except the drums and sang the lead on half the album. And the other was a genius named Joey Levine. And he wrote with a genius named Artie Resnick, who wrote Good Lovin' and Under the Boardwalk before he started writing Yummy Yummy and Chewy Chewy and Cook yeah. Joey Small. And yeah, so I worked with Kazanets and Katz. I didn't realize how visionary they were. I mean, they were not music guys, but they had some kind of ears and they were good at that nursery rhyme thing. They didn't like to pay people, but they fit right in with the rest of the gang over there.
Well, so you had started off making $20 a night playing piano at these high school hops. So you were doing better than that when you were working on these sessions, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, I was quite happy with the deal. I made $65 for 3-hour sessions. There was one session, the session with Yummy Yummy on it. We did 6 tracks, and we did 4 hits. We did 4 hits in one day. And we did it at the Wolfman studio. He was one of the partners in Atlantic in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember, but he was in a hotel. And there were times during the session when the tenants in the hotel were pounding on the wall. But there, so I'm making $65. We're doing 3-hour sessions. And if I was doing 3 sessions a day, that's $195 for a 16, 17-year-old kid. That's big money.
Yeah, absolutely.
But the way we made more money, like the guys making the hits, first of all, it was Kazanets Katz. They were making the records Buddha. Neil Bogart came over. He was a genius at promotion. And then there were guys who were factoring the money and really owned the label. We didn't really know the details, but one of these guys who was like, oh my God, what a powerful man. And to me, thank God he was in my life, a distant guy, Sonny Francese, who died this year, was 103 years old.
Huh.
He was Joe Colombo's brother-in-law. And, you know, he was... You never saw him during the day, but once in a while at night we'd see him. And he was involved in the label. And then there was other guys. And, you know, all rumors that we weren't privy to what was going on. But there were a lot of guys. And then there was a guy, I got to tell you, one of the most wonderful guys in my life. A lot of people tell stories, but I'll tell you, this guy was the best music business guy you ever want to know, Morris Levy. He was another guy. He owned Roulette Records. I remember there were some tough guys, and one of them once said to me, you could go down the street to CBS. You'll get 100% of your money, 100% of nothing. My records get to number 11 before we even know if they're good. He goes, and I'm not going to pay you, but I'll give you a name. And if you have a name, you can make a living. Someday you can take the money from some punk like you. Because when my day came, it was out of fashion. And I was quite happy to share my money with Joan Jett. We have a label. Worked out pretty good.
And you know what else, Kenny? You never had to put on a pair of cement shoes, you know? Because some of these characters...
And I tell you something, I always tell people, you know, a lot of these guys will tell you stories about being threatened. I never felt that an artist got threatened. They wouldn't kill you. They kill your career. And believe me, that's enough of a threat. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There was not that threat. In their other businesses, maybe there was problems. But I never felt threatened in any way. I felt if I was a stand-up guy, there was more honor amongst that crowd than there was amongst the guys running these labels. When I had hits, you know, I won't even say the name of the hit, but there was one hit I had. It was a monster hit. I brought the song to the session, and a major label didn't pay me for 36 years. You know, I mean, believe me, the game doesn't change. A guy who ran major label in England, who's a friend of mine, he sent me $3,600 for a hit, and he said he saw my name on a sheet, and I said, wow. And he goes, and in that conversation, he said to me, hey, there's a list of 10,000, but I recognized your name. If I paid everybody, we'd go out of business. That's not a gangster. That's a regular lawyer guy.
So you were playing with all these sessions. Did you ever tour? Well, I mean, you didn't tour as a member of the Ohio Express or 1910 Fruit Gun Company or Crazy Elephant. Those would be different guys that would go out on the road to support.
Different guys. Yeah. When Yummy Yummy was a hit, Jeff and Jerry flew to Ohio, and I think the first junior high school or high school hop they went to, they saw a band and they said, you want to be the Ohio Express. The Fruit Gum Company, who had a real lead singer who sang on most of the records, but not all, this guy Mark in New Jersey, he's a great guy, but they were out there doing Purple Haze and Simon Says in the same set, you know? I mean, but I was asked, I mean, Jeff and Jerry asked me to be the Ohio Express. I always wonder how that would have worked out. It would have been an interesting credit, but, you know, I wanted to be John Sebastian of the Love and Spoonful, and,
right,
you know, not do that. You know, I don't know how much time we were going to go through, but you know that when punk music happened, the punks liked Yummy Yummy better than they liked Sweet Judy Blue Eyes by Crosby, Stills, and Nash, which was an amazing turn of events, because in America, even, you know, I married my high school sweetheart, Merrill, and, you know, we've been together all these years, and I'll never forget, Yummy Yummy came on the radio. I had a car, buttons, and three FM buttons, and she pressed the FM button, and my record went off the radio, and Neil Young's Cinnamon Girl was playing. Uh-huh. And I said, what are you, crazy? That's my record. She goes, well, your record sucks. That's the way America was. They looked down on what we were doing. But eventually, the legendary Peter Meaden, first manager and producer of The Who, wrote the High Numbers 2 songs, Zoot Suit and I'm a Face.
Yeah.
He brought me to England, where my history was a benefit. The Brits, they loved all that pop music.
Mm-hmm.
And it saved my career.
Well, before we talk about that, I want to ask you a couple more things that are going on in the 60s. One thing is that you worked on the soundtrack to this Andy Warhol movie, Lonesome Cowboys. How did you get involved with that?
Or
do you have connections to, I guess, the Warhol crowd?
Well, not exactly. Artie Resnick and Joey Levine got money from Mike Curb. I don't know if your audience ever heard of him, but
yeah,
he made hit records. He had a very, very, very middle-of-the-road thing called the Mike Curb Congregation. He became lieutenant governor of California. He's a very interesting fella.
But before that, Kenny, he worked president. He worked with Davy Allen as well, and he had some blues theme and did some stuff with Davy Allen.
Yeah, I mean, he was very accomplished, dude. Yeah. He was a phenom. By the time he was 21, he was president of MGM Records.
And, right.
But he became president of MGM, and he gave a label to Artie Resnick and Joey Levine, and this fella came in with a song, and the Lonesome Cowboys was already out in a very few theaters, like little cult theaters in the village.
Right.
And what it was a meandering, sort of plotless movie of very effeminate guys dressed up as cowboys. And it probably, I saw the movie like 20 times. I and it's 4.5 hours long or something, and hard to follow. But whatever was, in those days, there was an audience for that, and they wanted to put a soundtrack on. So I was branching out and producing Bill Medley of the Righteous Brothers and Darlene Love and the Blossoms, and I was making, you know, big sounding records. And somehow, you know, they picked me to do this soundtrack. So Lonesome Cowboys, I thought I was doing like a Magnificent Seven John Wayne type movie. And I clashed with the fella who wrote it. And but I got along great with Andy Warhol.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a manager, Paul Morrissey, who I got along with then pretty good. And, you know, coming from my background of fine artists, I once talked to them about the art, and Paul Morrissey said to me, "Let me tell you something. We didn't hire you for your art. We hired you so we could make money." And I was like in shock. So, you know, that was the thing. And then, yeah, it was a great thing. You know, when you're young, you don't even understand the magnitude. I was in the factory with my wife. I completely was immersed in this culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I would tend to make some mistakes in my vernacular, you know, having grown up in a different world.
Yeah.
And it was pretty wild. It was pretty wild. There was, you know, Viva was there, and he was just signing this band that he was managing. You know who they were, right?
Well, I'm going to take a wild guess. You
know, the Velvet Underground.
That's what Velvet I was going to say, Velvet, right? Underground, but I thought,
yeah. The Velvet Underground. But, you know, I didn't really understand the magnitude of it all, you know. All I knew was the soup can, the Campbell's soup.
Well, so that's 68. Then in 69, I found a single issue that was credited to the artist Kenneth. It's Mr. Kane back with Morning Tide Woman. You've got songwriting credits on there. Are you the Kenneth?
I don't know.
You don't know? Okay. Well, I was wondering about that and wanted to tie that in with a question about 10 years later. I guess this is around 79. You had a solo single come out on Sire Records, Home for Christmas. And I was just wondering, how much did you ever want to have a solo career or pursue a solo career? Did you ever consider that?
Yeah. I mean, when we had the deal with the United Artists, I was the lead singer of a band called the Viscaines. We had, you know, that was in my head. I think lucky for me, I mean, that definitely would have been something on the agenda. But when there was a better lead singer, I was blessed to know that you ride the best singer. You know, I didn't want to, you know, I always laugh at, you know, I hate to name names because they're my friends. But, you know, when you've got, like, if you have Joan Jett or Tommy James in your band, why go out and make a solo record?
Hey, you mentioned working with Bill Medley and Darlene Love. And now did that take place in L.A.? You were in New York. Did you come out to L.A. to work with them?
Yes. Yeah, that was the first time. It was in 1969. And I drove my XKE out and went into the Hyatt House. Everybody was talking to me about Darlene Love. I didn't really understand the magnitude of her career because she was kind of a hidden treasure.
Right.
And he came in. As a matter of fact, it was my third or fourth. Bill Medley was doing a soundtrack song. And Darlene came in right away. The first session, she came in. And she came in with her sister, Edna Wright, who also had a hit, Want Ed, by the Honeycomb.
Right. Right.
But anyway, so then I met Darlene, and she did backgrounds and everything. And then Bill and I were producing this track for a soundtrack, and Darlene came in. She brought, like, 13 girls. It was Darlene and the Two Blossoms, the Honeycomb, which was three or four, the Sweet Inspirations, oh, my God, you know they are, Elvis Presley's backup band, and Mary Clayton, who had just finished working with the Rolling Stones on Let It Bleed. So this is the group that's out there. And I always sang backgrounds on the records I worked on.
Yeah.
So I go out there, and these girls, they start, "Are you crazy? Do you think you're going to come out there and sing with us with your flat white voice?" And I said, "Are you kidding me? I sing on all these records. You know, I've sang on quite a few important record. And they go, that ain't important to us. I said, well, let me tell you something. I'm not like these other guys. I don't bow down to Otis Redding because I think Frankie Valli is better than Otis Redding. How does that grab you? And they, one of them said, this boy's crazy. Let him sing on the record. And I did. Because that was always my attitude. I wasn't on, like, you know, all my friends were, you know, they revered. I revered Sam Cooke.
Yeah.
I revered Dion. I revered Elvis, you know what I mean? So anyway, you understand what I mean, right?
Yeah, totally. There's
nothing like you got. I said, you need my flat white voice to even it out a little bit. And I still believe that. So when you hear my Darlene Love and the Blossoms record, which horrified the label, you know, I'm singing with them. And it kind of, you know, their church like vibrato is wonderful. But my little flat voice on top, that makes something. It nullifies the vibrato a little bit, takes it out of the church and puts it back into the rock and roll. Just saying. I'm sure that you guys would be horrified to hear that.
No, the one of those tracks on your Laguna Tunes compilation, the first thing, Make a Change, that's Darlene Love and the Blossoms.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
That's the one.
And it's definitely got a kind of bubblegum feel to it. And, it, you know, it's bouncy. And
yeah.
I was going to say, when you talk about putting your flat voice in there, that it takes it, you know, as you said, out of the church, but also gives a sort of, it puts it back in the realm of every man, so we can all sing along and not feel like we can sing along with it. It's possible to sing along with them. I'm going to ask you about the Darlene Love thing. One other question is that I thought she was on, that Phil Spector had her to this tight contract and like wouldn't let her out for years and years. So you were working with her that right there at the end of the 60s. That wasn't a concern, having to deal with Spector in any regard?
Those guys threatened me, but I didn't care. I had tougher guys than they did. It was one of the great things about my past.
Yeah.
I really did. You know, I kept my nose clean. I walked out of there with great friendships, and yeah, he threatened, and I handled a lawsuit against Alan Klein and Phil Spector. But you know what's great about those guys? You know, like, I went to federal court in Westchester. Phil was there, and Alan Klein was there, and Alan Klein came over, sat down next to me, put his arm around me, and went, Kenny Laguna. He didn't care. I mean, I was like, it was so, no problem, lawsuit, next thing. He was ready to do business with me the next year. I'm not like that. I have maybe it's the vowel at the end of the name. You know, it's like, if you screw me once, shame on you. Twice, shame on me. I'm not like that. But he was funny, you know. And it was like he put his arm around me, like, no problem.
You know, one thing I think that is missing from today's hit parade, we could really use a lot more of, or novelty songs. I think there are plenty of parody songs, but just like a fun, oddball, novelty or silly song. And I count the Little Roger and the Goosebumps, Gilligan's Island Stairway, a novelty thing. Do you remember that? What was your involvement with that? Isn't it the band Earthquake?
Yeah. I wish I could take credit for the idea. That was Little Roger, and he had a partner, Dick Bright, and Little Roger and the Goosebumps, and his partner, when they were performing in the Bay Area, especially Berkeley, there would be lines around the block. They were so popular. And that was one of their songs that the people would go crazy over. So when Earthquake went to England for Berserkly Records, who had Jonathan Richman and Greg Kinn and Ruben Ouse, a lot of others, when they were in England, Earthquake came in. And since, like, I guess mandatory for a band of the 70s like Earthquake, they knew Stairway to Heaven inside out.
Yeah.
Matthew King Kaufman brought him into the Rampart studio, which was the Who's studio, and we recorded a track of Stairway to Heaven, which Little Roger then put the Gilligan's Island
lyrics
on top of. And then Joel Sullivan, the famous writer in the Bay Area, and Matthew, they put it out. And Led Zeppelin and Peter Grant and Louis Neiser, the famous attorney, and a bunch of bullies, they all went crazy. They sued everybody, including me. But I was strictly a creative person, which they determined. Louis Nizer's people took me to lunch, and then they wanted me to be a client. It was very funny. But I was innocent of being part of the business. It came down on them like a ton of bricks, all kinds of injunctions. And what would have been a hit record, that record was flying on radio all over the place, especially in the 70s when Led Zeppelin was still so in demand. Then when I was doing my Laguna Tunes record, I was just trying to chronicle some of my records that were so obscure. I mean, some of those records are hits, like Tulane, the only version of Chuck Berry's Tulane. He wrote it for his daughter. That was never a hit by him, but it was the top 10 record in England.
Right, so, the Steve Gibbons Band song.
Right. Look at you. So that means that me and you know about that. what happened was I became friendly with Page and Plant through Bill Kerbishley, the legendary manager of The Who. And, you know, I was able to get permission to put it on Laguna Tunes. So the Stairway to Gilligan is somehow in print because the injunction didn't go against me and I got permission from everybody. And Robert, you know, he laughed. He said, "That's really funny." I said, "Yeah, you didn't think it was funny in the 70s. He goes, "Were you that mean?" "Yeah, you were that mean. You don't know the reputation your band had." You know, it was like, don't step on Led Zeppelin's toes.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic port aboard this tiny ship. The mate was a mighty sailing man, the skipper brave and sure. 5 passengers set sail that day for a 3-hour tour, a 3-hour tour. And it makes me wonder. Now the ships are aground on the shore of this uncharted desert isle.
Credited to Little Roger and the Goosebumps, that was Gilligan's Island Stairway, or as it's sometimes listed, Stairway to Gilligan's Island. And with that, we end part one of our Coolest Conversations with Kenny Laguna. Thanks to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast, and join me next week for part two, when we'll discuss Kenny's moving to the UK and working with The Who, his returning to the States to work with Berserkly artists, including Jonathan Richman, and the beginnings of his long collaboration with Joan Jett. That's your next week's Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.